Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou. Today we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright. He's the executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Welcome back, guys.
Thanks for having us on the show.
Kevin, I want to start with you. There was a piece in Reuters that I found actually to be very funny. It wasn't meant to be funny. It's entitled Special Report, Death Sentence, The Hidden Coronavirus Toll in U.S. Jails and Prisons. And I thought, oh, okay, finally somebody in the mainstream is talking about what we've been talking about for many, many weeks, and that is the coronavirus toll in the penal system. Much to my surprise, I open up the article, and it's about the prison guards and how fearful they are that they're going to catch coronavirus. And it says here that they don't know who's infected. They don't know how they're becoming infected. Testing is off to a slow start if they're getting tested at all. More than 200 staff and inmates at this one jail in particular, Wayne County Jail, have tested positive. They don't know what to do. It just made me chuckle. The problem is not protecting the prison guards who are able to go home and go to a doctor and get medications on the open market. The problem is with the inmates who get literally nothing. Give me your thoughts.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, one thing it does get right is I noticed at one point it says that these confirmed cases within jails have profound implications for health officials and policymakers that are tracking the spread because epidemiologists see jails and prisons as key pathways of transmission. We've been saying that on this show just about every week, talking about how it's coming and going. Before the coronavirus was shutting down states, we talked about how, you know, if there was an outbreak in prisons, it would be from the guards, that they would track it into the prison. They would bring it with them because they come and go far more frequently than many visitors. And obviously, the people who are incarcerated aren't leaving those facilities. So they're not going to spread any viruses that don't come in off the streets. So, yeah, I think you're right. This reflects the way in which we talk about reforms and how they're usually focused upon what the impact will be for corrections officers or guards in these facilities. We often privilege their needs, what the their unions or the associations that represent them have to say as far as their interests. And, you know, we've talked about how we're not decarcerating to create safety, but it's always, I guess I'm waiting for maybe we need to build a few additional facilities or set up some ad hoc facilities so we can spread out these people, maybe contract them with some, you know, geo or core civic like company that can profit off the pandemic by jailing people and keeping them more spread out so that it doesn't get more intense. I mean, that seems like where this is going, because if you've got guards that are driving how you deal with this crisis, then you're never going to have people released who are vulnerable.
One of the things I think is interesting is that, you know, we kind of have a prior experience of dealing with respiratory-borne illnesses, and ranging from drug-resistant tuberculosis to Legionnaire's disease. And I think in some respects that what this shows is that the respiratory-borne illnesses are kind of equal opportunity. They infect the staff and the prisoners alike. But a lot of the critical components, as you note, are different. You know, the guards are making a choice, first off, to show up to work. They can press for personal protective gear, and they have access to medical care. I think we have those, but also what we aren't really seeing from public health officials is the acknowledgement that the prisons and jails are basically the vectors for the disease, and it's the staff that are going in and out of the prison every day. When you have three shifts a day entering and leaving these facilities, that's kind of the vector to spread it into both get it out of the prison into the community and from outside the prison into the prison. So even though prisoners can't have visits, they're locked down, or whatever, I think we're still seeing the disease transmissions that are still happening. And I think that doesn't really get, you know, that's not getting a lot of attention or focus. But one of the things I think that this crisis is also exposing is the whole desire in the last 30 years to use prisons as tools of economic development, where basically prisons were viewed as jobs programs primarily for poor white rural communities. And instead of investing in infrastructure, whether it's hospitals or universities or schools or anything like that, the government choice was to invest in prisons. And in the middle of a pandemic, that doesn't seem like that was that wise of a choice, you know, from any level, including from an economic viewpoint.
One of the things that kind of shocked me in this Reuters article was that the official count from the Centers for Disease Control of active coronavirus cases in U.S. prisons and jails was 5,000 inmate cases. That's preposterous. We know that's preposterous. Reuters, in a far more modest survey of local, state, and federal prisons and jails, found 17,300 cases of coronavirus. And in some of those facilities, they found infection rates of up to 65%. The conclusion here is we're just not paying attention to what's happening in prisons and jails. We don't really care what's happening in prisons and jails with coronavirus. And so the government, including the CDC, has just decided to ignore it until it goes away. Would you agree, Kevin?
Yeah, and I think that one of the things is just not wanting to make the investment, because you have to go through obtaining the resources and you have to secure these test kits and use them on prisoners. And I think, you know, especially early on, but it may to some degree still be the case, because as we've seen and talked about, there's not widespread testing. And so there's probably this view that we need to test only the people who need them, and the people who get tests become a metric for how you understand who is valued, whose lives do matter. If you can get a test, then society is basically saying that you matter. And so obviously early on, one of the things that was most glaring is that you saw all these rich people, including people in professional sports, getting tests, and everybody else was struggling to figure out a way that they could go to the doctor and figure out if they had coronavirus. And so, you know, you have things like recently in Nevada, they're basically just going to choose not to invest in testing for prisoners, and they're not releasing them, but they really don't care, and they're not going to go through the process of trying to test people in their facilities. And of course, like, it's obvious, if you don't test prisoners, then you don't know who has coronavirus. But, you know, if you don't have the numbers for who has the coronavirus, then those also can become useful to reopening and trying to push everything back to normal, because you don't have to act like there's a real crisis within those walls.
Absolutely true. I want to move on to a piece, Paul, that just had me shaking my head. And that is about the former warden of the Angola State Penitentiary in Louisiana. Angola Penitentiary has a well-deserved reputation as being literally the worst prison in America. It has the most notoriously bad solitary confinement unit. People die in Angola violently every couple of days. Warden Burl Kane was fired from Angola because of accusations of misspending. Well, lo and behold, he's just been hired to run Mississippi's state prison system. We've talked about the Mississippi prison system on this show. It is just about the worst in America, and it's actually been sanctioned by the federal government four separate times because of its inhumane conditions. Is there any good news at all in Burl Kane being hired to run the Mississippi system?
No, the only thing, I mean, I've been reporting on Burl Kane for decades, and the only thing I'll say is that he's as corrupt as the day is long, and he's as brutal as he is corrupt. One of our friends, Daniel Berger, wrote a book called God of the Rodeo about the rodeo at the Angola prison, where they use prisoners as unpaid slave labor to put on this rodeo once or twice a year that brings in millions of dollars from people going to see prisoners doing everything from roping calves to getting gored by bulls and stuff. And besides the Burl Cain siphoning off money from that, Berger recounts how basically Cain shook him down for a bribe, saying that if he wanted to finish his book, he needed to pay him money. And again, this is a situation where he's, you know, numerous of his associates around him were indicted and sent to prison on corruption charges. And I think the fact that Burl Cain, that his big defense when asked about this, is to respond and saying, I was never charged with a crime, is kind of pretty weak. I mean, and I would say that there's plenty of people with experience running prisons that actually can do a better job than others. But I would say that the big thing about Burl Cain is this guy's got a lengthy history of brutality and corruption that's well documented. I mean, this isn't a thing if we're like, hey, no one knows, you know, how Burl Cain runs a prison. And he's also got a lot of other troubling things. You know, for those concerned about the separation of church and state, he, for a long time, he used the prison chapel program at Angola to shake down people for money to fund it. And then also he showed marked proclivity to show favoritism towards prisoners that purported to be evangelical Christians. I'd say that pretty much almost everything that could be wrong with a prison administrator is wrong with Burl Cain. You know, when I saw the news story, I was kind of like dumbstruck. I mean, it's really jaw-dropping that of all the people to choose from to run a troubled, brutal, corrupt prison system, you would pick someone that has a lengthy history of brutality, corruption, and troublesome behavior.
Well, it's like an episode of Cool Hand Luke, isn't it? I mean, that's really what this is all about. It's just about hurting people. And they had to have done this. The Mississippi state government had to have done this on purpose. They're not blind. They're not stupid. They know the kind of man Burl Cain is. They know the history of his brutality and the history of his corruption. And yet they hired him anyway. So they had to have done this on purpose as a statement.
Well, you know, I think this is one of the things that when we, after the United States invaded Iraq, they basically, the State Department put together a task force of American prison officials to rebuild the Iraqi prison system, including Abu Ghraib. And I remember before the news of Abu Ghraib broke and the photos of the torture and the beatings and everything else came out, I just looked at the list of prison officials that they had, the fact that they had guys like Gary DeLand, John Armstrong, Robert Angelone. These were all guys that had left the running of American prison systems under clouds of brutality because they presided over regimes of brutality, death, and torture here in the U.S. that was got to the point it was so scandalous that they were fired or retired early. And it was like, so these are the people the United States hired to set up the Iraqi prison system. And then lo and behold, two or three years later, the revelations come out that the prison in Abu Ghraib had been turned into basically a torture center. And I think that the people you hire to run a system, and this isn't just prisons, I think this goes to any type of bureaucratic institution, whether it's prisons or hospitals or schools or universities or whatever, the values at the top are going to be reflected in how things operate down below. And you can't really expect good outcomes at the bottom when you don't have good, competent, honest leadership at the top. And like I say, it's just stunning to me that Burl Cain would get appointed to this job, especially given his track record. And the other thing, too, is that's also interesting, too, is that he has a long history of nepotism. The Times-Picayune in New Orleans a couple years ago did a lengthy story where they had a bubble chart that showed everyone employed in the Louisiana prison system that was related to Burl Cain. And A, he's got a very big family, and B, they apparently can't find jobs anywhere outside of the prison system. And it had everyone from his children to in-laws to grandchildren. And it's worth noting, Burl Cain's 77 years old, so he has a long history of brutality and corruption. And I think it's almost like every questionable business, legal, or ethical practice that can possibly be engaged in, you know, leaving aside the brutality, you know, leaving aside the beatings, keeping prisoners in solitary confinement for literally 40 years. The Angola 3 were kept in prison or kept in solitary confinement for, I think, 41 and 43 years.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, you name a civil and human rights violation, Burl Cain has committed it. But then just from a legal and ethical viewpoint of self-dealing, corruption, nepotism, pretty much you name it, he's done it. I mean, he's openly soliciting journalists for bribes. That's not exactly normal in the American prison system. And despite all this, the fact that they hired him to run the Mississippi prison system, I think, shows the priority or the interest that Mississippi legislators and officials are showing on how they view their prison system. It's really stunning.
Kevin, I want to move on to another issue. This is something that I just didn't understand at all. I had never heard of it. There's a new documentary out that reveals Silicon Valley's role in a notorious Bronx gang raid. I had never heard of this. It just didn't ring any bells with me, but it's actually quite important. Can you tell us about it?
Well, I believe this gang raid was something that we've seen prosecutors in New York actually defend. The name's escaping me, unfortunately, but he's a prominent person for the left who has worked in New York. And I remember him getting some flack for defending this. But anyways, this documentary is really important because it covers Palantir, which is the Silicon Valley company, I believe has connections to Peter Thiel. Yeah, Peter Thiel, who was part of the Trump transition team. And it's an analytics company that is really notorious because of the way in which it's enabled the deportation machine to work. And so this documentary spotlights how Palantir was used for this raid that went down in the Bronx. And this was a huge deal for that community because it wasn't just that they came in and targeted these people in the raid who they claimed to belong to a gang. It was that it wholly disrupted the lives of this entire community. There are flashbang grenades that were detonated. You have officers coming down with assault rifles. It was like your neighborhood was being invaded by the military in the middle of the night. There's video showing. And so we learn in this documentary that ICE's New York Homeland Security Investigations Violent Gang Unit was using Palantir as a mobile app guru, essentially. And they sat back and they were using their software. And they were there during the hours of this raid on April 25th, 2016. This is the quote from the email. FYI, we're all set here helping some random agents get set up, but we should have a good VIZ on everyone, and they're meaning visual. So they're going to be able to watch. So this is a surveillance team operation. They're going to be able to sit back and provide tactical intelligence, it seems. They're going to be able to tell agents where they can go, what people are doing in this neighborhood. They're going to be the watchful eyes as these ICE agents are essentially terrorizing this community to round up people. And they're using this framework that was, the Obama administration used it. It's obviously very popular under the anti-immigrant administration of Donald Trump and suggesting that you're just targeting people who are tied or linked to gangs and for deportation. I believe, I don't know as exactly as I probably should, but I believe that the vast majority of the people who got rounded up, if not nearly all of them, had no gang affiliations whatsoever. It was a huge scandal for New York, and people there were able to see quite clearly how bogus it is for them to conduct deportations with this kind of framework.
Paul, I want to move on to another issue and talk about Rikers Island, which we've addressed a number of times on this show. Rikers Island prisoners are helping to bury dead prisoners, prisoners who have died from coronavirus in a potter's field in the East River in New York City. I thought Rikers was supposed to be winding itself down. I thought it was supposed to be closing soon. In fact, it hasn't been winding down, has it? We've been talking about this for years. And instead, it's just getting worse. It's one of the worst hotbeds of the coronavirus anywhere in America.
And I would say, as far as, Rikers winding down, I'd say don't believe the hype. I think that, de Blasio, I think, they announced plans to close it down, but over like a multi-decade period. And I think that one of the things we've seen from prison and jail officials over the past 200 years of efforts at prison reform in this country is their number one strategy is just wait out their opponents and just put things off and reformers lose steam, they move on to other things or other things happen. So they kind of, you know, they're generally pretty successful with that. But no, there's actually no indication that Rikers Island is shutting down anytime soon. As we've seen, Rikers Island is definitely one of the hotspots, not just locally by New York standards, but also like globally. We have a huge number of people that have tested positive and have died of COVID in Rikers Island. And one of the things that's happened is prisoners that are dying in custody, they're being buried by other prisoners, are being buried at Hart Island in the Northeast Bronx. And one of the news reports said that normally there's 25 people a week are buried at Hart Island, which is generally where the city's indigent residents are buried when they die, and that the number of people being buried had gone from 25 a week to 125 a week. So almost a 500% increase in a fairly short span. And I think that this is something that's likely to, you know, probably to intensify. And I think there's also one of the things, too, is keeping in context the use of prison slave labor here in the United States. The prisoners doing the burying are being paid 50 cents an hour normally. And now, you know, I think is the big concession to the pandemic, prisoners are now being offered $6 an hour to dig mass graves on Hart Island for the people who have died from COVID. So, you know, I think it's almost kind of like, you know, one human rights violation compounds another.
We've got about 6 minutes left, Kevin. I want to talk to you about your home state of Illinois. Governor Pritzker made an order that could mean jail time for business owners who open in violation of his stay-at-home orders. Now, this is happening elsewhere, too. It happened in Texas a week or two ago. It's happening in California. It's happening in New York City, where business owners are actually going to jail for opening in defiance of their local orders to remain at home. Is this going to be an issue for Pritzker, or does he have popular support in Chicago and in Illinois more broadly?
Yeah, and I think you can draw a clear contrast between Illinois and Wisconsin, which is just to the north of Illinois, because there the Supreme Court basically shot down the state's stay-at-home order, really making it hard for Governor Tony Evers there in Wisconsin to control. Of course, that's the same state that forced people to go vote and hold their primary during the pandemic. In contrast, Pritzker has been maintaining that the stay-at-home order is going to continue to unwind with the phases that have been proposed, and that any businesses who try to reopen sooner than what the state would like to allow are going to face harsh penalties. And I just think that, you know, I don't actually believe that anybody, as a resident in Illinois, I don't see any evidence that any owners are going to be jailed as a result, but it just seems like that's what's being reported, because if you're charged with a misdemeanor, then you would be eligible for that. But I do believe that the prosecutors know that that would be handing the Republicans throughout the entire country a major propaganda victory to say that business owners were being jailed by Democratic governors. And so I think what's likely is that you could see these businesses have their licenses revoked, maybe temporarily or just suspended for a time. And that's probably the kinds of repercussions you could see for the defiance. You know, I mean, a lot of people on Republican side think that, you know, we saw this really crazy comparison drawn with it among the Wisconsin Supreme Court to like Japanese internment camps, which I thought was really, really ridiculous. A lot of these people think that being asked to stay home and not spread the virus is like being put in concentration camps, like your home is like that essentially, or like you're having this totalitarianism imposed upon you. And it's quite stunning to me, just because I think that this has really been beneficial to the public health. We've seen in the past week that the CDC itself says that had we shut down a week sooner, you would have probably saved 36,000 or more lives. So this has been essential. But we know, I think the panic is really unnecessary, because all of these people were going to reopen. The economy has been brought to a standstill, and everything that they're panicked about is probably going to be meaningless in the next month or so.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. We've got about a minute and a half left, Paul, and I want to talk very quickly about a piece that you've published in Prison Legal News about the Justice Department's decision to treat immigrants like criminals by forcibly collecting DNA samples from them. What's that all about?
Yeah, so I think this is almost like the, I think the big thing about how the surveillance state just basically scoops up more and more people and more data into its databases that better surveil us. And in March of this year, the Department of Justice announced that the Customs and Border Patrol are going to start collecting DNA samples from anyone, from immigrants being detained in ICE custody, including children and those legally seeking asylum. And I think this is significant because Congress has passed laws mandating DNA samples from people convicted of crimes, and the courts have upheld it. And the fiction belying this is that as people convicted of crimes, they don't have a right to privacy that would protect them. So by expanding this, the people in the immigration system, in the civil detention system, who everyone is in agreement are not criminals, have not been convicted of a crime, we're seeing pretty much the big expansion of this level of surveillance and the people that are, you know, frankly not, you know, they're not part of the criminal population and arguably have privacy rights and a right to privacy protections against having their DNA taken in the first place and, you know, not being surveilled and tested in this manner. So this is kind of a pretty significant, it's a very significant expansion of the erosions of privacy in this country. But again, it's not very surprising because critics like the Human Rights Defense Center, we predicted that once you set up these databases, the logical conclusion is they're just going to expand until pretty much they have everyone in them.
We are going to leave it there. We were joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we were joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright. Paul's the executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area, and in Kansas City on 104.7 and 102.9 FM and 1140 AM. You can also hear us at sputniknews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.